Well, as you've heard, you've probably heard it so far. We've been changing directions. Last week was the first time in this new series. For 16 weeks, starting last Sunday, we'll be in this series where we're talking about joining Jesus and pushing back darkness and what that means for us. This first section is, you heard me say it once already this morning, this first section, this about 5 weeks that we'll be talking about how can we join Jesus and push back darkness when we're secretly partnering with it. So pushing back darkness first starts with us. These first 5 weeks we'll all be focused on that. Does anyone know the story of Douglas MacArthur? Any World War II buffs? He's a five-star general that, if you aren't aware, when it comes to military, like PowerPoints is what I'll call them, the Philippines is a big one. It's kind of a local spot for that South China Sea, and it was a very important location and base during World War II. Douglas MacArthur was stationed there in the Philippines, and they loved him. They loved him and the local Filipinos loved him, loved the troops, so much that they grew fond over Douglas MacArthur and his authority there. They grew to love him. Well, in 1942, the Japanese attacked, and while Douglas MacArthur fought really hard and the troops fought really hard, ultimately they had to flee. And there's this very famous quote that as he was fleeing the island, there's this quote that surrounds him that he says, "I shall return." I don't know what that picture looked like, but it was probably a very valiant moment. Well, 2 years later, MacArthur and a large Liberation Army returned and attacked. They valiantly took back the island. It was a pivotal point for our location in the war. But he took it back, and in those, when he stepped ashore on this island of Leyte, he had fulfilled his promise of returning. He said, "I shall return." 2 years later, he came back with an army and took back the island that was taken from him. In those 2 years that he was gone, the locals never stopped rebelling in opposition to the Japanese. They remained loyal to MacArthur. When he came back, they had joined him in liberating the island. It's this awesome story around World War II. It's this awesome story, not because there's so much, you know, there's cool manly phrases or anything like that, and there's so much to celebrate in it. It's an interesting story because it mirrors the Christian story so well. It mirrors that when Jesus came to earth, he conquered sin and death, and for a time, he allowed darkness to remain here. But as he left, he said, "I will come again and take you to myself. That where I am, you may be also." So what do we do while we wait his return? We join Jesus in pushing back darkness. How? We're going to be talking about that in multiple ways. We're going to be talking about that from Psalm 24 this morning. If you want to open up to it, we'll read it together, and then we'll talk about it. It'll be on the screen as well. You can follow along if you didn't bring a Bible. But I'll be reading starting in verse 1. Verse 1 starts this way. It says, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully, he will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord, mighty, the strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory." This is an interesting psalm, as you could tell. We were singing those words, right? It's a famous, there's many songs written about it, as this is a song. That's what psalms are. It's very clear that David was a real musician. You could hear him at the end. "No, we're going to do that bridge again." Every person who's on worship got that joke. that he repeats that phrase at the end. King David is the author of this psalm, as he's approximately the author of like 3/4 of the Psalms. And as he's writing, there's some history here that I'll fill us in later. But you can see this flow as he goes through the psalm. First is the king's domain, then the king's people, and then the king's arrival. We're going to talk about that as we go through the psalm together. Those first two verses are some of the most powerful verses you can read in Scripture. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein, for he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. David first starts his psalm by establishing God's absolute authority over all things. Before God ever asks us to do anything, he reminds us that everything belongs to him. And when we read this, it kind of confronts a couple of things. It confronts the first and most difficult misconception. My life and everything in it is mine. That's one of the most common and difficult hurdles for a new believer to overcome. No, this is my life. What is in it is mine. That is not the argument being made here. What I worked for, what I earned, whatever it is, you fill in the blank, that is a challenge we have to overcome. But what David does is challenge that thought. If we put this in the right perspective, what he's saying is, I am not an owner of anything. I only manage what the Lord has given me. Resources, time, and talents, they are all the Lord's. When we frame that thought, in this battle against darkness, it gives us a very important perspective. God owns everything. David says, the earth, everything in it, the world, everyone in it. As a pastor, I'm often reminding us that we need to surrender to God, that we need to put everything on the altar. As we do it, we can view it the wrong way. It's not surrendering what belongs to me and what I own. We're acknowledging what already belongs to him. The farmer in his fields. The business. The church. Our children. Our time. Everything. Including our breath. It all belongs to him. This truth confronts the first and biggest lie. My life is not mine. It is his. The kingdom of darkness begins with self-rule. Adam and Eve were convinced and deceived into believing this very lie. They wanted to be like God. That's what the enemy tried to deceive them of. If you eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you'll be like him. Surely God would want you to have the knowledge of good and evil instead of just trusting God. The kingdom of God begins with recognizing God's rule. That's why Jesus often taught in regards to his lordship. In Matthew 28:18, just before the Great Commission, he says, all authority on heaven and in heaven and on earth is given to me. Jesus doesn't ask for portions of our life. He's claiming what is already his. Notice David doesn't say just the earth and the stuff belong to God. He says the people therein. People belong to God. This, for the believer, this means something different than for the unbeliever. For the believer, this has huge implications. You're not an accident. You're not self-created. You're not abandoned. You're not. you belong to the creator of the universe. And your value comes from whose image you were made in and whose possession you are. So when we look at following Jesus, when we look at following God, it gives us hope. It gives us encouragement that while it may be difficult, we know who we belong to. For the unbeliever, even though they reject God, they still belong to him. Does that give you any encouragement as you think about family members, as you think about friends who do not recognize God as Lord, who do not think that he is the creator of all things and loves them? It gives me great hope because even though they reject him, they still belong to him. This helps us frame why evangelism matters. It's winning back what already belongs to him. We're not inviting them to belong to him. They already are. We're inviting them to reconcile with the God who already has rightful claim over them. And the interesting thing is David actually tells us why. Why his argument is that that everything in the earth and everything on it belongs to him. It says that for he has founded it. David's argument is that God owns it, and it's because of that he created it. God owns because he made. When my son works on Legos, he'll spend hours working on a Lego build of some sort. We all know not to touch it because he made it. It belongs to him. If you touch it and break it, he's not very happy. How much more does God own his creation, his own creation, the one who has authority over all things? This is true throughout Scripture. In Genesis 1, God created and therefore rules over. In Isaiah, he says the clay does not question the potter. In Romans, the Creator has rights over his creation. This means that God's commands are not arbitrary. They're not out of left field. The one who designed us knows how we best function. So when he calls us to holiness, purity, forgiveness, generosity, or to worship, he's not imposing some foreign rule or some foreign thought. He's instructing creation according to his design of it. The last section of this can seem a bit odd to you and I, to someone who's reading it through modern lens. He says that he founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Why mention the sea? Why mention the rivers? In the ancient world, the sea was often a representation of chaos and no control. You ever been out to sea? Like really out to sea, not like on a boat where you can still see shore. When you go really out to sea, you start to feel just how small you really are and how little control you actually have. For them, David is saying that God built the world on top of the very things that seem terrifying and out of control. The seas that seem uncontrollable are completely under his authority. For this, for us, it clarifies a couple of things. We can look at all that seems uncontrollable and chaotic. Political chaos, cultural darkness, family struggles, disease, persecution, the list goes on. We can look at all of it and remember the God who established creation upon the waters is not threatened by the chaos of this world. Saul helps us join Jesus in pushing back darkness because we can remind ourselves that when we join Jesus in it, we're not marching into enemy territory. We go to join Jesus in claiming back what is already his. This next section, David transitions and asks this question, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? In other words, who can stand in God's presence? Who can represent God? Who can partner with him? And then he doesn't answer with ways that you and I might answer. He doesn't say the talented, the intelligent. He doesn't say the powerful. He answered with holiness, the one with clean hands and a pure heart. This means something very specific to David. In the Old Testament, he would be picturing the rituals, the ways that they would sacrifice, the ways that they would remain clean. He would be picturing something very specific. For us, it means something a little bit different as Jesus fulfilled those. Clean hands. That's talking about actions, what we do, the outward life. Darkness advances through sinful actions and the kingdom advances through obedience. He says a pure heart. That's the motives, the desires, the intentions. A person can have clean hands but a corrupt heart. You ever seen it? We talk about often in our home, it's not just what you do, it's why you do it. A lot of people do a lot of good out there, but we know they don't know or acknowledge the Lord. So they cannot have a pure, clean heart. And then he says, no idolatry. Who does not lift up his soul to what is false? Darkness gains influence whenever something takes God's rightful place. An idol is not just a statue. It is anything that we trust more than God. I know you've experienced it. You trust your own actions more. Yeah, I'm going to trust the Lord that he's going to step into this situation and he's going to help. But I better make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's crossed. We often lift ourselves into God's place. We sit on the throne. We trust our finances. Yeah, the Lord's going to provide, but I want to make sure everything is accounted for. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't steward well, but we trust our own finances, our own ability to provide security and safety. We trust success, politics, comfort, money, approval. We even trust ministry more than we do God. It's what we do in His name. Instead of remembering that He's the one who has authority. He is God who has authority over all things. David says something very specific, but points to something much larger. Next he says, and does not swear deceitfully. You ever notice that darkness thrives in lying? Darkness thrives when it comes to deceitful words. In John 8:44, Jesus kind of paints a clearer picture on why this is true. In 8:44, it says, you are the Father. As he's talking to the Pharisees, he's telling them, you are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. The people who push back darkness must be of the truth because the enemy is of lies. You cannot help push back darkness if you secretly partner with it. David doesn't describe perfect people. He describes as surrendered people. People being transformed by God's grace. People who seek his face. In verse 6 it says, such is the generation who seek him, of those who seek him. The focus, I want you to hear it. The focus is relationship, not performance. It's seeking the king. And then he goes into this next section where I joked about this bridge. I want to remind you, this is a song that David wrote. And David would have pictured something specific as he wrote this. And a lot of theologians, myself included, in verse 7, say that when David is writing that, he's picturing the time that the ark went into Jerusalem. The ark was a representation of God's presence. That was the dwelling of the Lord. And as it entered the gates, he would say, lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. This is the climax of his writing. And suddenly this imagery changes. A victorious king approaches a city. And the gates are commanded, lift up your heads, O gates. So the question is, who is this King of glory? And he answers, the Lord, strong and mighty. This is battle language. The king is won. The king returns victorious. But I want you to notice something remarkable in here. The people of God are not the heroes of this psalm, are they? They're not the ones who are marching in victorious. The king is. The victory belongs to him. Darkness is not overcome because Christians are strong. Darkness is overcome because the king is. The church does not defeat darkness for Jesus. The church participates in Jesus' victory over darkness. This is exactly the picture of the New Testament. At the cross, sin was defeated, death was defeated, Satan was defeated. The king has already won the decisive battle. We now live in his victory and are called to join him in the remnants of that war. Do you experience that? What part of your life does the Lord not have ownership over? Because his claim is that he owns all of it. What part of your life is still allowed to dwell in darkness? Are we still struggling because there's aspects of the heart that you're okay allowing it to honor Satan and not the Lord? A white lie. It's not a big deal. It's just a little bit. No one will ever notice. God says those who approach him are of clean hand and a pure heart. Do you need to be reminded that he is already victorious? Regardless of what you're facing, regardless of how difficult it is, the diagnosis, the financial burden, the looking out and seeing political darkness, he is victorious over all of it. So open up, gates. Lift up your heads. Psalm 24 reminds us that we don't join Jesus in pushing back darkness because darkness is equal to God and the outcome's uncertain. God doesn't need our help. The victory's already been won, but we have a responsibility while we're here waiting for his return. We join Jesus because the earth and everything therein already belongs to him. Every gospel conversation, every surrendered heart, every prayer, every evangelistic moment, every act of obedience, every life transformed. It's a declaration that Jesus is reclaiming what has always been his. Remember that story of MacArthur. He was leaving, and as he stepped off the island, he said, "I shall return." In those 2 years, the people continued to fight. That's you and I. As Jesus left, he said, "I will return and take you that you might be with me." The victory's been won, but you and I are called into joining him in rebelling against darkness until his return. Do you recognize God's authority over creation and everything in it? Including your own life. Do you see what God values from his people? Clean hands and a pure heart. Have you opened the gates for the king's arrival? Is this true for your own life? Do you help others to see the same thing? It's a very simple concept. It's a very simple invitation that we might join Jesus in pushing back darkness because he owns all things. He asks of you not something that you clean your own hands, that you clean your own heart, that you purify your heart. He's done that by his sacrifice on the cross. He joins you in that. He invites you to join him in that. And then says, "Open up. Lift up your heads, O gates. Be lifted up, O ancient doors." Is that true for your life? I'm going to invite the worship team up and pray. I want to ask you as I'm praying, how are you answering these questions? Are you prepared and willing to join Jesus in pushing back darkness as he's already won, but we have work to do until his return? Well, Father, I thank you that you invite us into this. I thank you that we're not fighting a war that we don't know the outcome. The victory has already been won. Lord, would you encourage us when we forget? Would you encourage us when we look and feel defeated? Father, the earth is yours and everything therein. Father, if I can be honest, I'm grateful that you claim authority over me. Father, go before us in this. Help us in the ways that we still struggle. Help us in the ways that we forget. We thank you and pray this in